You know, you might call this next story Food for Thought. In our series, The Human Edge, NPR Science Desk has been examining the evolutionary changes that make us uniquely human. Among them is our diet, or at least the diet of our ancestors. NPR Science correspondent Christopher Joyce has found there really is such a thing as brain food.
Our ancestors ate their food raw. Fruit, leaves, maybe some nuts. And when they ventured down onto land, they added things like underground tubers, roots, and berries. It wasn't a very high-calorie diet. To get the energy you needed, you had to eat a lot and have a big gut to digest it all. And let me tell you, having a big gut has its drawbacks.
You can't have a large brain and big guts at the same time.
Leslie Aiello is an anthropologist and director of the Venner Gren Foundation in New York City, which funds research on evolution. Digestion, she says, was the energy hog of our primate ancestors' body. The brain was the poor stepsister who got the leftovers, until we discovered meat.
What we think is that this dietary change around 2.3 million years ago was one of the major significant factors in the evolution of our own species.
That period is when cut marks on animal bones appeared. Not a predator's tooth marks, but incisions that could only have been made by a sharp tool. That's one sign of our carnivorous conversion. Aiello's favorite clue is ickier. It's a tapeworm.
The closest relative of human tapeworms are tapeworms that affect African hyenas and wild dogs.
So sometime in our evolutionary history,
we actually shared saliva with wild dogs and hyenas.
That would have happened if, say, we were scavenging on the same carcass that hyenas were.
Exactly.
But dining with dogs was worth it. Meat is packed with lots of calories and fat. Our brain, which uses about 20 times as much energy as the equivalent amount of muscle, piped up and said, "Please, sir, I want some more." As we got more, our guts shrank because we didn't need a giant vegetable processor anymore. Our bodies could spend more energy on other things, like building a bigger brain. Sorry, vegetarians, but eating meat apparently made our ancestors smarter. Smart enough to make better tools, which in turn led to other changes.
If you look in your dog's mouth or your cat's mouth, and then you open up your own mouth and look at that, our teeth are quite different. And what allows us to do what a cat or dog can do are tools.
Tools meant we didn't need big, sharp teeth like other predators. Tools even made vegetable matter easier to deal with. As anthropologist Shara Bailey at New York University puts it, they were like external teeth.
You know, your teeth are really for processing food, of course, but if you do all the food processing out here, you know, if you're boiling things, if you're grinding things, then there's less pressure on your teeth to kind of pick up the slack.
Our teeth, jaws, and mouth changed, as well as our gut. But adding raw meat to our diet doesn't tell the whole food story, according to anthropologist Richard Wrangham. Wrangham invited me to his apartment at Harvard University to explain what he believes is the real secret to being human. All I had to do was to bring the groceries.
You're a hero. My goodness, holding all this stuff up.
Let me take these out and show you what I brought. Got a bit of steak, which I hope can fill in for kudu or antelope or something.
Excellent.
Appropriate.
Okay, that's great.
And a turnip. You can take it.
Oh, one. Excellent. Right, really good.
Well, since you're English, I thought that the idea would be to get some tubers and boil the hell out of them.
Absolutely.
Plus a mango, some peanuts, and potatoes. Wrangham says that even after we started eating meat, raw food just didn't pack the energy to build the big-brained, small-toothed modern human. He cites research that showed that people on a raw food diet, including meat and oil, lost a lot of weight. Many said they felt better, but also experienced chronic energy deficiency, and half the women in the experiment stopped menstruating. Now, it's not as if raw food isn't nutritious. It's just harder for the body to get at the nutrition.
Are you going to try some of this raw turnip?
You're going to make me do it.
Well, I'll try some too. They've got a tremendous amount of caloric energy in them. The problem is that it's in the form of starch, which, unless you cook it, does not give you very much.
Then there's all the chewing that raw food requires. Chimps, for example, sometimes chew for 6 hours a day. That actually consumes a lot of energy.
Plato said that if we were a regular animal, we wouldn't have time to sit around and write poetry. You know, he was right.
One solution might have been to pound food, especially meat, like this steak.
If our ancestors had used stones to mash the meat like this, then it would have reduced the difficulty that they would have had in digesting it. Are you going to try it?
Or? I'll have at it. And that's quite easy to chew. It's not bad at all.
But not as good as cooking that steak.
Onto the fire. Whoa.
That's what Wrangham says was the really big change that created our modern body. Someone discovered fire, no one knows exactly when, and then someone got around to putting steak and veggies on the barbie, like this one in Wrangham's kitchen. People said, hey, let's do that again. Besides better taste, cooked food had other benefits. For one thing, cooking breaks up the long protein chains in meat that makes them easier for stomach enzymes to digest.
The second thing is very clear, and that is that the muscle, which is made of protein, is wrapped up like a sausage in a skin. And the skin is collagen, connective tissue. And that collagen is very difficult to digest. But if you heat it, it turns to jelly.
As for the starchy foods, like our turnip, cooking gelatinizes the tough starch granules and makes them easier to digest as well. Even just softening food, which cooking does, makes it more digestible. In the end, you get more energy out of the food. Yes, cooking can damage some good things in raw food, like vitamins. But Wrangham argues that what's gained by cooking far outweighs the losses.
I'm going to have some of the steak sitting under my nose.
Great, okay.
Wrangham likes to think that cooking also led to some of the finer elements of human behavior. It encourages people to share labor. It brings families and communities together at the end of the day and encourages conversation and storytelling. All very human activities.
Ultimately, of course, what makes us intellectually human is our brain, and I think that comes from having the highest quality of food in the animal kingdom, and that's because we cook.
So, as the Neanderthals like to say around the campfire, bon appetit.
Cheers.
So, cheers.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Who knew the Neanderthals spoke French? You can find all the stories in our Human Edge series at npr.org/science.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Don Gagne. We have more news about an oil spill today, the one in southwest Michigan. As many as 1 million gallons of crude spilled from a broken pipeline and flowed into the Kalamazoo River. Cleanup crews are working to keep it from reaching Lake Michigan. Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams reports.
Exactly when the 30-inch pipe burst is a point of contention. Residents in the little town of Marshall, Michigan, say they smelled oil on Sunday morning. The energy company says it didn't detect a leak until Monday. But either way, before the pipe was shut off on Monday, roughly 150 tanker trucks of oil poured into a creek and then flowed into the Kalamazoo River. Some 50 families are now being asked to evacuate because of air quality concerns. Health officials say the area where the spill occurred is highly toxic, and they want people to stay away from the river. Kayla Nelson lives in Marshall.
I'm kind of scared to drink the water, but I'm not sure. I haven't heard anything, but I'm just kind of scared myself to drink it.
EPA officials are now testing the water to see if it's safe to drink. Officials in Calhoun County are advising some families to drink bottled water instead. The Kalamazoo River feeds into Morrow Lake, and officials have been hoping to stop the oil before it reaches the dam on the lake, which they're calling the last line of defense. That's because it's about 80 miles east of Lake Michigan. So far, the EPA says the oil has not reached the lake. Wesley Boland lives below the dam, where the water is still oil-free.
Yesterday, I told the kids it would probably be their last time they'll be able to play in the river. It's sad. The big fish that we caught up here, the pike, what's it going to do? We can't eat them. You know, I've ate them my whole life. And it's sad. It's sad. It's sad. I don't, you know, what more can you say?
Governor Jennifer Granholm has declared a state of disaster. While criticizing Enbridge Energy Partners, the Canadian company that owns the pipeline, for not doing more to contain the spill. Granholm worries the oil slick will pollute the wide, sandy Lake Michigan beaches at the height of tourist season.
it would be a tragedy of historic proportions if this breached into Lake Michigan.
Vacuum trucks have been sucking oil off the river all week. Enbridge officials say they've collected much of the oil, but admit there's still a lot on the river. Patrick Daniel is the company's president and CEO. Maybe with BP's public relations nightmare in mind, Daniel began yesterday's press conference by restating what he's said since he arrived in Michigan.
We take full responsibility for the cleanup, and we will be here until you are happy in this community and in this county that we've completed our responsibilities.
While it's not known what caused the pipe to rupture, the U.S. Department of Transportation has cited the energy company for repeated safety violations. Just last January, the agency sent Enbridge a warning letter about a section of the same pipeline. As the cleanup work continues, Enbridge officials remain confident that they can stop the oil's forward progress before it reaches Lake Michigan. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Williams.
In that other spill in the Gulf of Mexico, BP has already spent more than $4 billion and will be spending billions more on the cleanup effort. That includes a lot of human costs, cleanup workers, checks for shrimpers. But our economics team, Planet Money, wondered about the non-human cost. How much should BP pay for dead and injured animals? NPR's Robert Smith went searching for the price tag on a pelican.
I started out pretty far from the Gulf, the Bronx Zoo. Ted Bregg comes here every week to take pictures of the pelicans.
They're just beautiful, and they're easily photographed. They almost pose for you.
So as he shoots, I ask him to estimate, what is a wild pelican killed in the Gulf worth? He lowers his camera.
This can't be done. They're dead. All the money in the world won't bring them back.
I will hear this answer from just about everyone I talk to on this story. A pelican, they say, is priceless. And you know what? That may actually be the right answer. But it's not a useful answer. In economics, saying something is priceless is like saying it's not worth anything. You can't present an invoice to BP for infinite dollars. And you sure can't rely on the marketplace to come up with a fair price. It's illegal to buy or sell pelicans. No eBay, no Craigslist. But there are places where people are spending money on pelicans, and that can give us this starting price. Next stop, Hammond, Louisiana, the oiled bird cleaning facility.
The approximate number of pelicans that have come through is about 600.
Jay Holcomb runs the International Bird Rescue Research Center. He says BP is spending millions on this cleaning project, but that's not a normal price tag. Back in California, they figured out, in general, what it costs to save a pelican.
It's an average number, and we're saying $500 is about it.
Now, from an economic perspective, this strongly implies that whatever the value of a pelican is, it has to be more than $500, because that's how much you're willing to spend.
I didn't make that leap, but yes, I guess you could say that.
Okay, we got $500. $500. Do I hear $1,000?
You could probably buy a pelican in Europe. No, I'm guessing, but probably for around $1,000.
Okay, there you go. Mark Jackson is a Hollywood animal trainer. He doesn't own a pelican, but he's coached them for movies and ads. And he says they can bring in a lot of money. One company is renting pelicans at $4,500 a day.
And over its lifetime, theoretically, it could make you, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Okay, so we're up to 100,000, but, you know, we're still missing something. How much do Americans personally value a wild pelican flying free? Luckily, there are experts who calculate the incalculable.
Gardner Brown, Professor Emeritus of Economics, University of Washington.
Professor Brown became a bit famous in this field decades ago when he figured out how much people valued a wild duck. $30. The 30-buck duck. He talked to hunters.
I asked them how much they would be willing to pay for one more duck.
So if you could walk home with 12 ducks instead of 11 ducks, how much would you slip some guy money under the table?
Or be willing to pay to change the harvest regulations.
Now, there's a lot of sophisticated math and design to make sure people aren't just guessing. But this survey method became the standard. Professor Brown helped put prices on endangered spotted owls and viewing elephants in Africa.
The economists got really angry with me years ago. They've changed and said I was bizarre that I should try to value an elephant. Because they're creatures of God.
I thought I'd give this survey thing a shot. So I went back to the Bronx Zoo, and I posed the question like Professor Brown might. How much would you personally pay to have stopped pelican deaths in the Gulf? The numbers were all over the place.
I would contribute our vinyl siding account, which is maybe around $10,000.
$1,000, I would pay.
I would pay a dollar, for sure. Yeah, that's not a lot.
A dollar? $10,000? $1,000? I think I'm creating volatility in the Pelican market. But it turns out there is a very simple way to avoid all of these problems.
We do not value them on an individual, let's go to the store and buy one.
Roger Helm is the chief of environmental quality for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And he says after an oil spill, they used to do exactly what I tried to do. Survey, figure out the cost for each animal, and total it all up. But now they look at the big picture. An offending company is required to spend whatever it takes to restore the population to its original level.
They kill 47 pelicans. They owe the public 47 pelicans. They are responsible to make the public whole.
And there's no single price. For instance, a company might build fences around a pelican nesting area to help increase the population. That's a cheap fix. Or the restoration could be really expensive. There's talk in the Gulf of having BP create new barrier islands for pelicans. Best of all, though, this technique skirts that awkward question. So when I ask you, how much is a pelican worth that died in the BP oil spill?
My answer is, that is worth one pelican.
And the price for a turtle is a new turtle. A dolphin, a dolphin. There's no need to do the conversion into dollars. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
President Obama is arguably the nation's electric car booster in chief. He has championed federal loans to automakers to build them and tax credits to consumers to buy them. As a candidate, he pledged to put 1 million plug-ins on the road by 2015. But according to what John Volker reports, in California, those brand new Chevy Volts may be on the road soon, but they may be stuck in the dinosaur lanes, not in the HOV lanes. John Volker is editor of GreenCarReports.com and joins us now from New York. Hi.
Hello.
And how is it that GM and Chevrolet can't advertise the Volt as a car that'll not get you to work cleaner, but get you there faster because you'll be in the fast lane?
When GM had to make some decisions about the equipment they were going to put in the Volt, some of the rules weren't exactly defined. And so they had to make a decision for tooling that they would equip the Volt's engine for a certain level of emissions. There's a complicated taxonomy. I won't go into them, but they decided to take it to a clean level, but not a sort of an uber clean level. And as the rules for HOV lane access were written at that time, that did not qualify the Volt to get in, whereas zero emissions vehicles like the Nissan Leaf electric car are allowed to get in.
But the Chevy Volt, from what I've read about it, is a car that if you're not going more than 40 miles that day, it won't burn any gasoline at all. It'll just be going on its battery.
That's exactly the case, and it gets even more ironic because there's a vehicle coming out in 2012 called the Toyota Prius Plug-in Hybrid, which is essentially like a current Prius, but you can recharge a larger battery pack by plugging it in. That vehicle will run at lower speeds on electric power only, but if you take it on the freeway at freeway speeds, its engine switches on. And yet it's designed for this other emissions level that, in fact, does let it get on the HOV lane. So you have this paradox where the Volt, which can run with no emissions in electric mode at freeway speeds, does not get in, whereas the Prius plug-in hybrid will get in despite running its gasoline.
Access to the HOV lane without any other passengers in the car is one privilege for fuel-efficient cars. But there's another one. California has a pretty hefty rebate if you buy a car that qualifies, and the Volt doesn't qualify?
That's correct. The highest rebate, $5,000, goes to an all-electric car like the Leaf. It was expected that the Volt would qualify for something like $3,000, but in fact, that same emissions level is required to qualify, so it does not.
Now, the California Air Resources Board told us today that they haven't yet decided on the rebate or on access to the HOV lanes. Is this just a case of a regulatory body not yet having dotted the I's and crossed the T's, or is there a problem of substance awaiting this plug-in car?
The regulatory body has known about the Volt for a couple of years now. GM has to make its decisions on a much longer time horizon. So certainly CARB could go in, create a new category, or tweak its rules. But as the rules stand at the moment, the Volt doesn't qualify.
When President Obama was visiting Detroit today, GM announced they're going to increase by 50%, they said, the number of Volts that they will
produce, you've pointed out that isn't necessarily a real increase.
Well, they have said for many years, their executives both on and off the record, that in the second and third years of production, 2012 and 2013, they would have the ability to produce 60,000 volts a year. So the increase to 45,000 for 2012 is still well within that capacity. And I guess what I'm saying is this is not necessarily something new or different. This is simply an announcement that they are committing to a higher production number than they did on July 1st.
An announcement assisted perhaps by a presidential photo opportunity.
It would be inappropriate for me to comment on that.
Well, John Volker, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
John Volker, who is editor of GreenCarReports.com, spoke to us from New York.
BP's incoming CEO, Bob Dudley, says it's time to scale back the Gulf oil spill cleanup. At a news conference today, he also announced that James Lee Witt, the former head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, will help BP with the recovery that remains. NPR's Jamie Terabe reports.
Bob Dudley chose Mississippi, where he grew up, to tell everyone it's time to scale back parts of the cleanup. Those guys in hazmat suits stalking Gulf beaches, some of them are leaving. And further out in the water...
We've had some good news offshore, you'll know that. But that doesn't mean we're done. We'll be here for years.
Dudley says with the leak stopped, there's very little oil left on the surface in the Gulf. Thousands of fishermen who've been out of work have instead been earning money working as part of the BP cleanup effort. But with less oil on the water, there's less need for skimming and laying boom. Dudley points out that some fishing bans have been lifted, so boats can go back to work.
What's happened in the last few days is larger and larger areas have been open for fishing now, and that's a good sign, and we're going to put lots of people will get back to work doing what they want to do, which is the fishing.
Some state waters along the Louisiana coast have been reopened for fishing, but some areas remain closed. Shrimper Eric Hebert, who delivers boom to skimming vessels in the Gulf, says he isn't ready for a scale back or ready to fish.
We got way too much oil in the Gulf, not accounted for, and basically the way we feel out here, until it's all gone in the Gulf, nothing should be cut back.
Yesterday, he says, his boat pulled out 32,000 feet of oiled boom, the consistency of peanut butter. During the shrimping season, he and his crew live off what they catch, cooking it on board. But he doesn't feel safe doing that now, and he feels BP is betraying the people who live here.
Personal note, I feel BP's basically seems like they're trying to back out of here and get out and leave us with the mess is what it seems like.
During the press conference, Dudley acknowledged that words meant little and action mattered more. But he also admitted that BP hasn't been very competent in processing the thousands of claims coming in. BP's turning the work over to an independent administrator after prompting by the White House. And he also announced the appointment of James Lee Witt and his Crisis Management Consulting Group to handle the long-term restoration efforts. Witt was director of FEMA under President Bill Clinton. He says it's critical the recovery plan meet the people's needs.
I've seen the anguish and the pain that people have suffered after disaster events. I have seen communities come back stronger and better than ever before.
BP also announced that it's giving a Louisiana charity $100 million to help oil rig workers out of work because of the moratorium on deepwater drilling. Dudley says the company's written more than 80,000 checks worth $250 million and was selling assets around the world, he says, to make sure it can keep its financial commitments in the Gulf. Jamie Tarabe, NPR News, Biloxi.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden.
The BP oil spill is on its way to becoming what some say will be the most massive tort litigation ever. And as both sides lawyer up, as they say, they're also trying to hire the best and brightest scientists to help make their case. But as NPR's Tovia Smith reports, that's raising concerns.
As soon as the magnitude of the Gulf oil spill became clear, it was all hands on deck.
That's the black mangrove. Their distribution and range has expanded over the past 20 years in coastal Louisiana. You wouldn't have seen this 20 years ago.
For months now, local scientists like LSU wetlands expert Andy Nyman have been out on Gulf waters advising the cleanup and measuring the damage.
Some of the carbon being photosynthesized by these marsh grasses today will be part of a menhaden that will end up in a piece of chicken that then you cook on your stove.
But there is growing concern that some of the best minds are being sidelined since they've signed on as paid consultants to BP.
Everybody's arming up for the big day in court.
Richard Shaw, director of Louisiana State University's Coastal Fisheries Institute, is one of many concerned that BP is buying up too much of the region's brain power.
You would think you would want to bring all the intellectual resources to bear. It's pretty frustrating.
Shaw says he has not been approached by BP, but many colleagues have.
I got a phone call from some lawyers representing BP.
University of South Alabama's Bob Shipp says BP's lawyers tried to hire his whole Department of Marine Sciences to do research for them. Under the deal, the scientists could only disclose their results if BP said so. Otherwise, they'd have to keep it secret for 3 years.
They wanted the oversight authority to keep us from publishing things if for whatever reason, they didn't want them to be published. People were muzzled. As part of the contract, they were muzzled. And certainly, it's not something that we could live with.
But other professors did accept BP offers at LSU, Texas A&M, and the University of Southern Mississippi. After a blast of public criticism, however, the Mississippi professors had a change of heart and backed out. They declined to comment. It's touchy, not just because of the academic integrity issue, but also public opinion.
I am a little concerned about everyone hating me if I was working for BP, so.
LSU wetlands scholar Andy Nyman chose instead to work for a lawyer suing BP. His deal calls only for expert testimony, not research, and he's not subject to any hush clause. But Nyman says he can only surmise how many others are, either for BP or the government agencies who will oppose them in court.
I'm guessing from the volume of people who are wetland experts that you do not hear from in the press right now that everyone but me is locked in.
BP declined to be interviewed for this report, but in a statement, BP says its deals vary from large, no-strings-attached grants to universities to, quote, scientific experts for the purpose of litigation that need to be confidential.
It's the way things work. I mean, this happens every day, and no one should be surprised.
Mark Davis heads Tulane Law School's Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy. In some ways, he says BP is doing what other oil, tobacco, and pharmaceutical companies have done in the past by hiring scientists to do research they want kept secret. But he says in a case like this, the public will pay a big price if BP can constrain the free flow of scientific data.
When the best fisheries scientists actually may have evidence that would work against you, but they're not able to present it to the other side or to the public, well, then you've essentially bought some silence.
It's a cagey legal strategy, but I do think it's a problem from a public standpoint.
That's attorney Robert Weigel, who represents fishermen, businesses, and environmental groups who are suing BP. He says the public interest really depends on access to a relatively small pool of specialists.
When you talk about the red snapper fishery or black mangrove swamps, there may be half a dozen people who fully understand those resources, and there needs to be full exchange of data so that we can all understand what happened to these public resources.
To many in academia, an underlying problem is the lack of other options for research. Shaw says universities have all but cut back and federal grant money has all but dried up.
There's a bunch of frustration. I mean, believe me, everybody, all the scientists want to get out there and contribute, for crying out loud. I mean, it's in our backyard. And so we're sitting there chafing at the bit, trying to get into the mix.
It only makes a lucrative offer like those from BP, Shaw says, all the more enticing. Tovia Smith, NPR News, New Orleans.